Aloha mai kākou. Aloha kakahi aka. So welcome to this session. I am your moderator for today. And before we get started, I wanted to just remind you guys all to ho'opio, na kelepona pa'alima, turn off your cell phones, make sure it's on silent. We're gonna have our first presenters today, Anna Berg and Edwin Ko, and I will let them take it away. Mahalo nui.
So can everyone hear me?
No.
Can everyone hear me now?
No.
I don't know how.
The moderator's job.
The moderator will try.
Oh, there we go.
There you go. All right. Better? All right. Aloha. First, I want to thank the conference organizers, and I also want to thank the people of Hawaii for hosting us. I'm very pleased to be here. This is my first trip to Hawaii, and I'm overwhelmed by how welcoming it is. And I'm also overwhelmed by this conference. It's amazing. So thank you very much. We wanted to introduce a project that we just started over the past year. And
You can just click on
click.
Them. Yeah.
I'm not technologically advanced myself. So we wanted to work with place names, and I'll explain why in a bit. But basically, place names are important for a variety of reasons. I'm sure most of you are aware of these. They are code for which places are good to hunt, travel on, find resources. In other words, they are a cultural memory. They also give a sense of place and history. They're shortcuts to remembering important events in the community. They also allow one to reclaim ownership over the land. Names are political. The colonizers came and replaced indigenous names with their own, based on different cultural values. They memorialized non-indigenous peoples and so on. Documenting for many endangered language communities, they may first steps may include recovering the names and pairing them with places on maps, and that's in fact what has been happening in the community that I work with. But next steps may be a bit more difficult, especially because of the level of cultural endangerment in many places. So recovering the context in which these place names were created is sometimes very difficult. And what we wanted to do was work with some tools that could provide context in a different way. So we're using interactive story maps as a tool for that, and we're going to talk about that in this presentation. So the outline of the presentation is we'll talk a little bit about the place naming documentation, previous practices ranging from everything from bare bones place names paired with places on a map versus a more full-fledged, rich, three-dimensional view of place names in context. And then we'll talk about what we're doing, which is combining maps, photographs, various kinds of stories, and so on. We'll tell you about the communities that we worked with, what kinds of stories they had related to place, and where they're at with language documentation work, and what feedback we got. And finally, we'll talk about the mapping software and how useful it was, how it may help or may not help, depending on the communities, and how it gets passed on to the communities. So first, looking at place naming documentation. Here, I am not a specialist in this area, so I know that there are many of you out there who probably have far more experience than I do working with place names. I'm going to talk mostly about my experience working with the communities that I have been working with along the Aleutian Islands and the Pribilof Islands in Alaska. So the genesis of this project for me came as I was doing some historical work, which involved trying to show that there was a substrate influence at work in the names that we find, for example, on Kodiak Island. But how could I prove that if I don't even know how names are assigned, how they're given, how do we interpret a place name that is unsourced etymologically. So how do I know that something refers to a geographical trait, or to a body part, or to a historical event, or a prehistoric event? I don't know that. So I have to know how place names are assigned. But I couldn't do that, because for the Aleutians, where there's extensive place naming documentation, it's at a very basic level. It's place names linked to a map. And I'll show you on the next slide here. This is what we have. Now, we have phenomenal documentation of Unangamtunu, the language spoken on the Aleutians. But we don't have much context to go with this. How do I go back? Is this way? Okay.
Yeah.
In Alaska, we also have many other place name projects that have much more context. So, for example, the work of Carrie and other collaborators on place names with maps, ethnographic information, personal stories, etc. So there's a lot of diversity in the type of documentation that we have. And more recently, we also have some web-based place names and ethnographic documentation, such as the Yupik Place Names Project that was supported by the National Science Foundation. Again, this is something that is basic place names on a map with accompanying audio. There are different tabs that tell you what type of ethnographic information you could expect to find, but it's not paired with the maps here. So in our project, we wanted to bring that multidimensionality out. We were trying to do that in a way that was easy to do with minimal funding, and that could give local ownership. We tested it on two different communities, the Onangan on St. Paul Island and the Crow in Montana. We did this field work in the summer of 2018, we first started in St. Paul Island, and Edwin came with me, and then he took this idea back to the Crow community and developed it there. What was interesting was we had two very different reactions experiences with this, so we thought that would be interesting. We used Esri Story Maps. It's an online digital storytelling platform. It allows us to combine the various types of documentation that we were looking for, but we don't have to know how to program to do it. So it's relatively easy to use. There are a number of different templates that we could use that give us different experiences with it. And it's open source. It can be owned locally. And it can be used on different platforms. So very quickly, St. Paul Island is one of the two islands in that square there. And here's an older map of it. And it's the Unangah language is the green around here. Okay. The language has been very well documented for several centuries. It's considered very well documented compared to many other indigenous languages. It's typically place name documentation typically, like I said, has consisted of this pairing of names on a map. The tribe of St. Paul has been working very extensively on language learning materials. With a documentation component including place names, oral histories, cultural practices, and more. And in fact, they've recently been looking into figuring out how to use stories for language revitalization work. And we kind of piloted this. We hadn't quite gotten to the story maps yet, but we piloted something with Ilan, which is text to audio alignment, to work with stories. And it didn't really work for us for what we were doing, so that's partly also why we moved to this story place thing. Now, interestingly, there were a number of different types of stories related to place, stories that explain a place name, and some of them are not obvious. So Hungry Man Road was so-called because people must have been very hungry to build a road in difficult conditions in the spring when there's lots of snow and sand on the road and so on, in order to get to a place where they could anticipate getting the ducks that they wanted to eat. Kusuluh, a place to get angry, is a place to negotiate who's going to get the best hunting grounds. And what's interesting about this is that it's it's sort of semi-mythical, actually. St. Paul Island has only been populated for about 200 years, so all of the place names are new. And this one, no one that I talked to could actually remember having had an argument at this place. It was just a place where it was known that people had arguments. And its interpretation is somewhat up for question. It's not clear exactly where on the map it belongs, and other place names depend on it for their interpretation. So there's a lot of interesting stuff around this. Other stories could comment on cultural activities, the use of the place, associations with a mythical person, and so on. And here's an example of the latter. Oh, no, that's coming up later. What we did was we tested them out in different locations on the island with one or more stories for each place and several different versions of each story for each location. And we then provided the English and Unangah audio, both the transcriptions for both languages, the photographs, and maps. And this is sort of what my version of the story maps looks like. On the right, you see the different tabs that you would hit. You can hear the audio. Anyway, you get the idea. Oops. The only thing that I'm a bit clunky with this. I haven't figured out how to show a map and a picture on the same page, and also how to show multiple pictures on the same page. So it is a bit clunky. It's a little bit more primitive than my vision. And the feedback was, yes, indeed, it is a bit clunky. This is a quote. Trying to figure out how best to use it, need to take time to think about it, not quite sure how to, you know, maintain it, add to it. Maybe we'll get someone else to deal with it, right? But honestly, this feedback is based on email communication. And the other thing to know about this is the community has very unreliable internet, and it's very expensive to get good internet connection. And so for the vast majority of the community, even something like this is really not going to be where their focus is. So it's not clear how useful this would be to them. Anyway, that was the experience we had with that. I'm going to turn it over to Edwin now.
So using my experiences on St. Paul Island, I then sort of started a project working with several community members on the Crow Reservation. And so Crow is a Siouan language that is spoken in southern Montana, primarily on the reservation, which is indicated in the red box. So it's estimated to have around 3,000 speakers, but over 90% of the speakers are over the age of 40. And so in the response to the decline of the number of speakers, there has been a number of grassroots efforts. And so one such effort is a collection of Crow place names and narratives associated with them by the Tribal College since 1996. And this has led to the creation of the Absaloga place names database, which is displayed on the right here. There is also a web-based map linking the place names to different geographical locations, but that website is no longer maintained, nor is it accessible. Yet despite of all of these efforts, there are still some very important gaps in the documentation of place names. One example involves the town of Lodgegrass. So Lodgegrass is just right over here, which has multiple Crow names. One of the names that is commonly used is Ashbajeche, or Valley of the Chiefs. So working with an elder in the summer of 2018, he referred to Lodgegrass as Ishbadawahabe, which means fallen bell. And so when I looked into the place names database, what I found was that Ishbadawahabe actually refers to a different location, 30 miles north of Lodgegrass near Crow Agency. And so And it was named that way because the bell that used to call the workers fell from its holding brace. And so I asked around, particularly those who grew up in Lodgegrass, whether they've heard the name being used or they've used it themselves. And people have said that they have heard and have used Ish Bada Wahabe to refer to Lodgegrass, but no one seems to know the origin of that name. One person even suggested that Ish Bada Wahabe was the first name given to Lodgegrass. And so there are perhaps other place names that have not been included into the database. There are also many place names in the database that don't have a corresponding explanation for why that name was given. So in the summer of 2018, I began collecting stories relating to different places in Lodgegrass, but also in other towns on the reservation, with a focus on abandoned buildings or buildings that are no longer there. And so you may be wondering, well, why buildings? So in the naming of many places, particularly towns on the reservation, buildings seem to have a very high historical and cultural significance. So for example, Baja Waja refers to the town of Crow Agency because of a mill. And Amola refers to Wayola being based on the Crow name, which because of a train station. And both of these buildings are no longer there either. So not only do these kinds of stories have a great potential to lead to a better understanding of these different place names, but they also contribute to other central aspects of Crow history and culture. And so this is the story map that I demoed for Crow. And on the right here is a map of Lodgegrass, and the different pins refer to different locations, each with a set of stories of people's experiences or memories about these different locations. On the left is about Cozy Corner, which was an old cafe that was recently burned down. And so here are different, underneath are different recordings of people recounting their memories. So this is just an example.
Lodgegrass could take one store, the guy on the corner, go he get Cozy Corner, he had to go get a set TV, what guy waited, a set TV.
Yeah, so I received a number of different feedbacks from the community, and I've only displayed three of them here, and I'm only going to play a recording for the first one.
I think this is pretty good. I think the most useful tool for this would be is to go out and have people map out these battlegrounds and say, this is what happened here.
Right.
And then tell the story that happened in Crow, and have them tell it in English. There's a couple of well-known battle sites. You know, this is what happened. This is the Crow name for it. Mm-hmm. You know, this is how you say it in Crow. This is the story in Crow.
So where do we go from here? Well, based on the feedback, there's a need to collect even more stories about even more places from even more people, especially from elders. So I discussed with the Tribal College Archivist, and we decided that eventually this website should be hosted on the Tribal College Archive website. I'm also planning on holding a workshop in the coming summer to teach anyone who might be interested in learning more about this tool and documenting and presenting some of the stories that they've collected using the Esri Story tools. So for example, the recording that you just heard discussed about how there's a great potential for this tool to be used to collect different stories about battle sites. So now I'm going to talk about the Esri story maps. So here is just a quick demonstration on how one would go about creating a story map. It's not supposed to sort of, once you've watched this video, it's not supposed to have you know how to create one, but the purpose is just to show you how relatively easy it is to create it. So first of all, you just click on Create Story. You have seven different templates to choose from. I'm just going to click the map journal one. And when you create your map story, you first give it a name. I'm just going to say hello. And you have a main stage where you can insert images or maps, and the side panel is where you add text. So for now, I'm just gonna create a map. I'll just call it hello as well. And here you can sort of drag, you can focus in on a particular location that you want. And so I'm gonna focus on California. So I save it, and when I go and click next, I insert the text that I want. And here I'll also say hello. And there it is, the first story map that I've created. So for all the multimedia content that's displayed on the website, story map authors can provide a link to where the content are being stored. So Esri actually also allows integration of third-party hosting services, such as YouTube for videos or Flickr for images. They also allow authors to upload images directly to the website, but not audio or video content. So they never really possess or own it. They just display it. And there's some ways about how ownership can be maintained by local communities. So when you first create the story map, you need to sign up for a free Esri account. So you can share your account information, like username and password, out to the people who are tasked with maintaining or updating the maps. Local communities can host their photos and multimedia content on their own website so that Esri does not own or possess any of that content. And communities who have a dedicated technologist can also download the open source code and place it onto their own web domain. So our suggestion for those of you who may be interested in this tool is that you should first evaluate how the story map suits the project's purpose and goals, as well as to the needs and values of the community. In addition, you might want to think about how it can augment or enhance current revitalization efforts. And it's important to get feedback at every step of its development. And finally, you should ask yourself, do the benefits outweigh the goals, or outweigh the drawbacks for using this tool? So, thank you very much.
Does this have potential for collaborative map creation, or is it just like one user that can then create a map?
Yeah, so you can share your account information with several people, and like all those different people can collaborate on building the map story. Yeah, so they can. I'm not sure whether or not multiple people can be doing that at the same time. That's something that I'm not sure of, but that's something that could be tested. Yeah.
So you say you're holding workshops in the summer. Mm-hmm. Are these going to be online or in person?
This is going to be in person. Okay. Yeah. This is something that I've discussed with actually the person of the recording that you've just heard about the battle sites. And so this is something that I'm planning on doing at the Tribal College.
Okay.
Yeah.
With the situation with your two Crow cities, was there perhaps a migration from one to the other?
Yeah, so historically, Lodgegrass used to be, there used to be a lot of people living in Lodgegrass, but I think over the time, people have sort of migrated to Crow Agency when the buildings were being set up over there. There's a large history of a lot of white people living in Lodgegrass, and during that time, there was also a lot of Crow Indians over there, but I think once the white people left, that over time, people sort of migrated to other parts of the reservation just because there used to be a sort of larger business in that particular town. Yeah.
Have you found working with the Crow, because it seems like the names that you were giving out were names from post-colonial time, do they still refer to some places that would have been pre-colonial names, or in names that are post-colonial, do they have stories of why it would have changed?
Yeah, so there are several names for the different towns, and some of them do refer back to pre-colonial times. So for example, Lodgegrass, the one that's being used normally, is it means Valley of the Chiefs, because historically a lot of the chiefs were from Lodgegrass, and so that's the name that was given. And so a lot of different places also sort of have the pre-colonial context that's involved.
It's really interesting. I do a lot of that kind of work just to. I'm really interested in that, my own history as a Dene from Satu in Canada. And one of the things that's really interesting is a few years ago, maybe about 20 years ago, there was somebody in Kinchon that was also very interested. Had a phrase that we use a lot. We said our history is written on the land. And one of the things is it is, because we don't. It's our oral history. And one of the things that's so important today that I find we touched on, and I think Anna touched on it, is okay. You can know all kinds of place names. It's fine. But you want to know how that connects to the land. What connection it is to Mother Earth, and then and also relationship, because that's what tells you what the true name is. Because I go through, and then I find that here, that even just the brief presentation, I know that a lot of the things are similar, although the language is very different, because I know in Alaska, you're doing some work there, and interpretation of the constellations. Many people all have that as well. So finding out what happens in other ways really helps support or understand those connections to the land. And that's where the term, I use a term, pass the water, pass the land. Because those, including the language, because if you can't make those connections, then it's just the name. And you're not going to understand it. And if you don't understand it, then it's just a whole bunch of names. It doesn't really mean anything to the ecosystem on Earth. And then you talk about ownership and community. That's a huge issue, huge challenge to bring in. That's the way to do it. It's like saying the Earth, somebody talked about the history of placement so far. Well, I've been doing that for the last 40 years with my grandfather. You take, this belongs to the, possibly belongs to the Catholic Church. Or this possibly to the government. The RCMP. And then you say to yourself, what is left? That must be what my grandfather was thinking. But it's hard, because I've gone to institutions and I have a lot of that stuff in my head as well. But that makes it easier to understand that, okay? Like a natural world is the same, regardless of whether you interpret in English, French, or any language. If that doesn't change, what changes is us. So that really is very good, and I like the way you keep going back to people that are there. They're the ones that should be interpreting. And they should. So I see for long to speak, and that's good. I love that. Because I'm doing it one day. You see, you talk too much.
Yep.
Oh, I a twofold question I had. What was your impetus for getting this project up and running? Did you get pushback from the community, or did you have large-scale buy-in within the tribe? Like, who was the pushback from if you got it?
Sorry, is this question for me or Anna or both?
I don't know.
Okay.
Whose project was this?
So, well, it was a combination. I mean, he's the technologically savvy person,
okay.
And I had a vision, but I didn't have the means to implement it. So it was collaborative. We started off with the Onangah community, but unfortunately, so we went and did some field work there with the help of the community. They knew what we were going to do. They wanted place name documentation. They wanted the stories, but we didn't at that time know about story maps. So unfortunately, I haven't been able to be there, present it, talk it through. And so it's not that there's pushback. It's simply that there hasn't been the opportunity to demonstrate it and to show it to the whole community. So the feedback I got was, yeah, it might be interesting, but we need to think about it. So there's more room to do it there. The this is all design. I told them basically. I said, look, this is what I said I would be working on. This is what I've come up with. It's very clunky. I don't know. I'm not very good at it. But this is how to use it. And let me know if it's useful. If you want something changed. But we're at this point. If you want this, if you like this, it's all locally owned. You can take over the whole thing. And I can come out and show you how to do it and so on. So we're not at that point yet where we've gotten either pushback or, the other thing is how public to make it. It's totally not public at this point. So it's totally dependent on the community. But, you know, when you start getting different people's version of a same story, and especially with the hunting stories, that can get kind of personal. And I didn't feel comfortable saying, here you go, here's a project, right? Because that's not my place to do, and that's very much up to the narrators to, have a say in what gets put up and so on. So my part is very much at the developmental stages, and I can't do anything more until I actually go out, talk to people about it and so on. But Edwin, by the time he went out to Crow, had already had this idea in mind, and I think he can talk more about his reaction.
Yeah, so when I was on the reservation and working with people to collect these different stories, I was building the story map at the same time and showing everyone whose voices are incorporated, A, whether they would be okay with their voices being online, and B, whether or not, what their opinion of this the thing is and what they want changed, if any, and just getting feedback as I was constructing this. So being able to be out on the reservation and develop this at the same time and getting feedback from everyone, that was one of the reasons why the feedback was very much positive. It was just because I was able to do that, working with different people and getting their different feedback.
I appreciate both those answers, because my question is coming from where I found a dichotomy in working with this over the last 30 years. You get into technology and get these things out on the web, all of a sudden, your own people, some of them become reticent about this. I thought this was for us, this information. Now it's for the whole world, and everybody can use it. We have no idea how to use it.
So sorry, we are up on time. I think this is a great discussion,
okay.
And
okay.
We can continue it, but let's thank our speakers one more time.